So next question is from Natasha. I would love some help with a client who is not actually a client, but my soon-to-be 13-year-old son. I feel confident in my understanding of anxiety and compulsions, but haven't been able to help my 12-year-old manage a steadily growing compulsion to remember and confess anything in his past he may have done that was, inverted commas, wrong. Like a parishioner going to confessional, he began confiding in me the wrongs he's done in his career as a small child and beyond, and this has become worse and worse. Despite my attempts at reassuring him, reframing, normalizing, helping him understand how anxiety and thoughts interact, helping him with 7-11 breathing, etc., It seems to be steadily getting worse. We're at the point where he blurts out past wrongs and repeats it over many times, along with a sort of mantra, which is his apology and expression of regret. I reassure him of an unconditional love, but that doesn't really help. Any advice on how I may better work with this would be great.
Okay. thank you, Natasha. I think sometimes people have an underdeveloped conscience, you know, quite clearly they do. And he sounds like the opposite to a psychopath. But sometimes people have an overdeveloped conscience as well, you know, so ruminating about our sins in inverted commas, or seeing perhaps neutral behaviors as sins, can cause so much, you know, torment, you know, self-torment. So conscientiousness as a personality trait is extremely predictive of professional and other kinds of success, or even longevity. But too much of anything creates diminishing returns, you know. So he doesn't, of course, want to get rid of his conscience altogether, heaven forbid, and you wouldn't want that either. But he does need to dial it down quite a lot by the sounds of it. Now, one aspect of all of this is that sin, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder, you know. So most behaviors or attitudes that have been sinful or seen as a sin at one time in one culture have been seen as virtues in another, you know. So pride, for example, was seen as a sin, and now often we encourage one another to feel proud and so forth. So I wonder where did his ideas of right and wrong originate? Okay, so who says that they're sins? Did these ideas come from him? Did he decide that what he'd done in the past, as his career as a small child, were sinful? Or had these ideas been grafted onto him from elsewhere, okay, from some excessively rigid or judgmental sort of ideology? So that might be one thing just to think about. Because it's interesting, some people sort of devise their own morality system, you know. So you often see this in anorexia, you know, although lots of anorexics tend to share similar sort of ideologies as to how they go about things, modus operandi, that they might feel guilty for doing this, or I never have that on a Monday, or I shouldn't do this on a Tuesday, or I shouldn't have more than once, and so forth. So it's almost as if they've concocted their own morality. And you see that sometimes in obsessive compulsive disorder, that it's somehow sinful, that they need to repent in whatever way that might be. Now, it could be self-harm or sort of, you know, vomiting or whatever. That's an extreme example, and that's something else. But it is interesting, you know, so it doesn't necessarily come, this morality framework from elsewhere. It might purely come from him. I don't know. But it would be interesting to explore that. But obviously too much focus on whether we're good or bad people, and some focus on that isn't a bad thing either, you know, but too much focus on whether I'm good or bad, or I must be a bad person, otherwise I wouldn't have done this, or, you know, it's kind of very binary. It's very black or white, you know, very all or nothing. And it sort of causes people to lose perspective, you know, or perhaps makes them feel they have to be perfect in order not to be wicked. Okay. As if it's not a continuum. Okay. Sometimes we need to, of course, cut ourselves some slack, which isn't the same as making excuses for ourselves. Okay. So sometimes to have objectivity about ourselves, we need to think, okay, I screwed up there. Okay. And, but there were mitigating circumstances. You know, I didn't have the full picture. I didn't have all the context. And that's, you know, had I known now what I knew, no, had I known then what I know now, then I would have behaved differently, but I didn't have the full picture or whatever. Okay. So we're understanding why we screwed up. Okay. So, you know, so he needs to sometimes be able to say, okay, I screwed up, but I didn't know that that was a sensitive issue, or I didn't mean for that to be offensive, or I didn't intend to cause pain. Okay. So that would be a marker of improvement. Okay. You can actually run through some scenarios with him as well, you know, with imaginary children doing wrong things, and then you could have him generate mitigating ideas. And because it's about other children, then it would be less personal, you know, but then he could start to see the pattern of how to use his brain a bit differently. Okay. Which don't just damn the wrong action or damn the wrongdoer out of hand forever. So you can get him, you know, sort of good at doing this. So you could ask him Socratic questions such as, you know, if John doesn't know that James's mother is dead and asks him about his mum, and James becomes upset, is that worse or better or the same as John knowing full well that James's mother is dead and asking about her because he wants James to be upset? Okay. So sort of morality questions, Socratic questioning. And you could do, you know, and if it's not as bad, why not? You could ask him, okay, what causes the difference? Okay. So, and you could discuss with him the difference between mistakes that are intentional, that are unintentional, and intentional acts meant to cause harm. Okay. And how should each be dealt with in retrospect? You know, should it exactly the same way, or should there be a difference? Okay. Is there anybody who doesn't make mistakes? Okay. Who does he know who's never made a mistake? If you name someone, you could ask him to go and ask that person whether they ever made a mistake or ever upset somebody. Okay. So you're widening his perspective, and you can do that through scenarios. Okay. And you can come up with, you know, 10 or as many as you like, and sort of do that as an exercise with him as a way of helping him loosen up his thinking a bit. Okay. But you could also discuss the nature of right and wrong as well. You know, who's to say, you know, that things are right or wrong, you know, because what's wrong in one context is right in another. Okay. To take a knife to somebody, I'm not suggesting you say this to him, but to take a knife to somebody and to cut them, okay, would be wrong in a dark alleyway, but it would be right on an operating theater if you had to save their life. Okay. So the nature of right and wrong isn't always straightforward. And sometimes, as we know, good actions can lead to evil outcomes, and evil actions can cause good to happen. Okay, as a result. So, you know, the law of unintended consequences and the idea that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and that good can only really come into being because there's evil in the world, you know, kind of yin-yang idea and so forth. So, but there's also the idea, I suppose, as well, that if we were perfect to begin with or naturally entirely good, then there'd be little room for self-development in life, and therefore a big purpose of life would be missing, you know. And we all tend to come into the world, you know, a bundle of appetites and greeds and wants and selfish impulses and so forth. You know, we can pretend we don't have them, okay? But you don't tend to see toddlers pretending they don't have them. They're quite honest about that, okay? And we, you know, as we grow into adulthood, we put a sheen over this and we learn to hopefully control those impulses, or mitigate them by doing good and so forth. But that's entirely natural that those impulses should be there because they're there to make us survive. Okay. So it's a weird idea that by being able to do bad things, you are able to survive in the world. And by bad things, I sort of mean selfish things, really, you know. So, and even the word selfish is judgmental and relative, okay, in that context. But it also sounds a little that his behavior is, you know, bordering on obsessive compulsive. And you actually described it as a compulsion. And often these kinds of obsessive compulsions begin during times of excessive stress, of not feeling secure, and as a way, at least unconsciously, of trying to feel more in control of a life that's starting to feel chaotic in some respects. So, you know, when did this begin? What was going on in his life? Was he influenced by anyone who was extremely concerned with propriety, with rigid ideas of right and wrong, of shaming wrong think or wrong action and so forth? You know, was he exposed to that? Or was he going through a period of uncertainty? And helping him feel more secure generally may also help naturally dissolve these compulsions, because there's less fertilizer to feed them, so to speak. Okay. But also it might be useful to talk with him about what he feels would happen if he didn't carry out his ritual. Okay. What would happen if he didn't blurt out these mantras? What is he fearing? Okay. What is the fear behind the fear? That he's a bad person, that he's irredeemable, that he's damned, that he can never come back and be good, you know, in the world and so forth. And you could also even present the idea that there is an argument to say that no one can ever be genuinely good unless they've been a bit bad before, okay, because they don't really understand the nature of good and bad, or, you know, right and wrong in that respect. You know, we're better people when we can register when we've behaved less well than we thought we should have done in some way, or did bad, but then move on, hopefully, to no longer, you know, repeat such mistakes or wrongdoings. Okay, so we register it, but then we move on. Okay, because that's all we can do. A bit, well, you know, we might be able to make amends or so forth with a person that we've wronged, but ultimately we have to move on, register it, and not repeat the same mistake again. Okay, or to do it much less. But I'd like to know the nature of these supposed sins, you know. So can you talk to him about sins or wrongdoings as a continuum? You know, is treading on someone's toe accidentally the same as intentionally defrauding someone over many years, you know, or is it a continuum? Are there different levels? Okay. Which ones can we sort of just disregard as not being significant, you know, particularly? I can feel bad for 5 minutes about accidentally treading on someone's toe, but ultimately I need to move on from that. Okay. Yeah. But I also wonder to what extent he's concerned with stopping doing this, or whether he feels it's a necessary confession ritual to absolve sin. You know, does he see the behavior from the outside and recognize it as something he needs and wants to stop? Or does he feel the behavior is not the problem, but the sinfulness is the problem? So, you know, we'd need to help him get to the point where he starts to see the way he's responding to his sin, if you like, as the problem rather than the sin itself so much. I don't know what he's doing, but, you know, if he does reach the point at which he sees the behavior from the outside as something that's unwanted or has outstayed its welcome and no longer serves him, but serves against him, can you devise a plan with him to begin to cut it down, to taper off it, you know? So often we taper things down, you know. When you relax him, you could talk about what it'd be like to be 30% less controlled by this in a week, or 40% less controlled. What was it? What would his week look like? And so rather than you've got to stop this immediately, which is a big leap, you know, if you look up a staircase, you don't ask someone to leap the whole staircase, but they have to go one step at a time. And it's the same sometimes with cutting down these sort of obsessional things as well. And if this judgmental part of him was a person, who might it look like, and what might they sound like? Would they have a sense of humor? Would they have a sense of perspective? You know, how big would their nose be? Okay, you could get a bit creative with helping him externalize the problem in that way. And in that way, also, you help him start to see it as an interloper, but not who he really is. You know, a part of him that started to sort of control everything that got above itself. But actually, it's a small part. The conscious mind isn't necessarily the captain of the soul. You know, it's an important team member, but it doesn't have to boss everything, and it doesn't have to see problems where they don't exist. Okay, so what would he say to this part of himself? Okay, if it's tried to boss him around in future. Okay, so you could get creative with externalizing that part as well, so he doesn't feel that it's his core identity, that it's just something that's been going on. Yes, but certainly what you've been doing as well, getting him to control his physiology, the 7-11 breathing, normalizing and so forth, can be really useful. But hopefully there's a couple of ideas there that are new.
I think if you're comfortable, Natasha, with using the word OCD with him or the term OCD, you don't have to. I mean, the worry gremlin, you know, could be, but the people use all sorts of different ways of describing it. But what Mark was saying there about externalizing it in some way can be very, very powerful in my experience, because you can then introduce tasking. You can then say, so in what ways are we going to outwit the OCD or the worry gremlin, and to help him understand how it's worked on him, how it's, you know, it says, oh, you might be a bad person, you must confess to feel better. It's like the whole thing's a game, the whole thing's a trick that it's been playing on him. How can you start to outwit that? You won't succeed every time. There'll still be times you'll blurt out things during the day. But as Mark was saying, how can we taper that off? How can you start to rebel? What if you started waiting 20 minutes? The worry gremlin says something to you about, you know, you must have done something wrong. You'd better blurt it out to confess and then you'll feel better. How can you rebel against that for 20 minutes and start to outwit it? What if we, you know, if you could, if you've been blurting things out 25 times a day, approximately, if over the next week we start to get that down to 20 to 15, you know, that then we'll be outwitting the worry gremlin or outwitting the OCD. So externalizing naturally lends itself to all these kind of tasking types of therapy. How can we outwit it? How can we rebel against it? So useful ideas there as well, I think, which I found that very effective for working with people with OCD.